from New York City. This is a special edition of Auto Line This Week. Here now is your host, John McElroy.
Welcome to Auto Line This Week. Typically, we come to you from Detroit, but today we're in the Big Apple, New York City. And joining me on today's show are John Murphy, an auto analyst with the Bank of America, Joe Philippi with Auto Trends Consulting, and Jamie Kitman, the New York Bureau Chief of Automobile Magazine. Join us for our discussion in the historic Stanford White Studio in the Chatwal Hotel. So, Jamie, John, and Joe, great having you here on AutoLine this week, and it's great to be in the big city, the Big Apple. But I've got to ask you guys, what blows me away whenever I come to New York is how much people are really into cars. I mean, here's a city where you're almost crazy to own one, and yet I can't believe how much people are into it. Jamie, why is that?
Well, a lot of people live in suburbs, first of all, but I think people just like cars. If you went to the New York Times editorial board where their view of the world is shaped in the taxi ride from West End Avenue down to the Gray Lady, they seem to think people don't care, but they're always sort of shocked themselves when they run stories about cars and there's a huge reaction to it.
Joe, you're
well,
a guy.
Well, the Times, coming off what Jamie just commented on, you know, the Times does have this column called Wheels, and it's a very well-read column, and they do a lot of interesting stories in it, and very often feature people in town that are car collectors and, you know, from modest backgrounds, and they've got some really interesting old cars stashed away in a garage somewhere, either in the city or out in Queens. But this is a big market. You know, we're looking at New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Long Island. A huge market for every type of product that the automakers manage to churn out every year.
In fact, I've heard that if you look at the greater New York area, it's the single largest market in the country.
Yeah, I think it's something on the order of like 16 million people are involved in, you know, in that 50-mile circle around New York City. So it's a lot of potential, a lot of sales potential here. And it's a big, big market for the, you know, premium and the luxury end, you know, whether it's SUVs, sedans, sports cars, you name it.
And another thing not to forget is that thanks to Robert Moses, New York City was really designed, you know, the modern New York City we know with cars in mind. I mean, they haven't done a lot of work, you know, for the last 30 or 40 years, but prior to that, it was one of the first great auto cities.
And that should be mentioned for those who don't know. Robert Moses is a guy who had an enormous influence in the city for laying out what it looks like today.
Truly.
John, what do you think of why New Yorkers are so into cars?
You know, I think there's a lot of people that are real familiar with the yellow Crown Vic and riding that almost every day. So that's a big draw in the city. But I also think there's a lot of dreamers in the city, and they love to dream about bigger and better apartments and bigger and better cars. So I think it's a real aspirational market that draws a lot of people to the desire to own a car. I know if you look at the city, though, your carrying cost on a garage is probably more than your car payment. So that keeps a lot of people at bay, but they all do really still dream.
So what do you make of where the auto industry is right now? 2 years flat on its 2 years ago, flat on its back. Everybody hurting, not just the Detroit automakers. Everybody was hurting. Now it just is rocking ahead.
Well, I think we're in for a real boom time in the U.S. auto industry. We hit the mid-14s or 14.5 for the first quarter for this year for a run rate basis. That's up from 12.7 last year. I think what you see in the autos that people tend to forget is it's a really big contributor to the economy. It was traditionally about 4% of GDP. Dropped to 2%, is now beginning to recover, and it's going to start really kicking in a big way to the economy as it really expands above 14 million units. It will start hiring because you're going to need more people to make all these cars, and it's going to be a really big exponential contributor to the economy. So I think it'll be a big deal for the economy.
Joe, how good are the legs in this recovery? How long might this go on?
Well, I think we could have a 3 to 4 year run as we get back, you know, churn our way back to 17 million maybe in 4 or 5 years.
See, I love hearing you say that. Some people have told me, oh, it'll never go back to the old days. I, like you, believe it will.
Well, you know, we took the market from 17 million, what, John's 6 or 7 years
2000,
ago?
2004, yeah.
Right. You know, down to 10.2 or 10.3 million at the bottom. So, you know, you create a tremendous amount of pent-up demand. You know, employment's picking up. Credit is steadily opening up. You know, it's not great yet, but, you know, credit's getting better. So, you know, the economy's starting to gather some momentum. And the other thing that we haven't talked about yet is fuel prices. So if you've got a 10-year-old car or even older than that, you're kind of hurting from a fuel economy perspective. And now you get full-size sedans, you know, the Buick LaCrosse being one example, the new Impala that's coming up, I guess, late this year, early next year, you know, well up into the mid-30s in terms of highway fuel economy, depending on which engine option.
Yeah, high 30s, in fact. And Nissan just announced the Altima, which is, what, I think 38 miles per gallon highway. So that's not a full-size sedan, but it's a good-size sedan, and that's pretty impressive fuel economy.
Yeah, I mean, talking to one of the GM folks, they indicated that they're targeting for the new Impala with e-assist 37 miles to the gallon.
So, Jamie, I got to believe that a lot of this recovery has got to do with the fact that there's some pretty good product out there.
I would think so. And, you know, it's ironic, but I think the high fuel prices, you know, have been fortunate for the car companies, going to Joe's point, that they really were going to be out on a limb. Certainly Ford was going to be out on a limb if prices, gas prices remained low, having invested all this money in high-efficiency cars. So I think, you know, in a weird way, while it doesn't make anybody happy in the short term, I think in the long term it's going to be good.
And yet that doesn't seem to dissuade people from buying high-performance cars or even trucks. I mean, truck sales may not be growing as fast as smaller cars, but they're growing strong.
Yeah, no, it's a fact. You know, people, I think a lot of it is related to what their level of optimism is about the economy. And as people feel more optimistic and as credit opens up, because there's always people who will spend too much money if they can't give them a chance.
Right. Yeah.
One of the real interesting things is used car prices are actually at all-time highs. So when a lot of people are going into showrooms, they're finding it really easy to buy a new vehicle because they have $2,000 or $3,000 more in equity in the trade-in of the vehicle. So that is really pushing people to buy more expensive cars, but also actually just to execute and close the deal and actually buy a new car.
But that's, of course, because there's a shortage of good used cars. Nobody can get their hands on enough of them right now.
It's one of the great knock-on effects of having really low sales from 2008 forward is there aren't a lot of good late model used cars out there. So there's a real shortage. Despite what a lot of people say that there's too many cars in the United States, you might actually argue to drive 3 trillion miles a year, you need a lot more cars than we have on the road right now.
But will that hurt the sales 3-4 years down the road, Joe, as we fill up the used car fleet, as it were? Would that impact new car sales?
Well, residual values will probably start to ease back. But if the economy is still humming, and if employment continues to, you know, the overall employment numbers continue to improve and wages continue to grow, they'll start to offset each other. And I don't think that'll have a negative effect on the market.
Jamie, you were talking earlier that you've had a chance to drive the new Maserati SUV.
No, sorry. I saw a reveal of the new Lamborghini SUV.
Oh, Lamborghini SUV. Yeah. Oh, excuse me. That's a big...
After 8 or 10 years, the post-Volkswagen period, kind of reestablishing their sports car credentials, it's not official yet, it doesn't have a name, but they've shown an SUV that they want to start selling pretty soon. They say maybe, but it looks like a done deal to everybody who's at this reveal. It's not surprisingly, it's very closely related to a Cayenne and the equivalent Volkswagens and probably the new Bentley SUV that they're talking about as well. And notably, they think they're going to raise their annual sales around 200%. I think they sold 1,600 cars in 2011. They're expecting to go to 4,500 cars with the SUV, the addition of the SUV to their lineup. I'm sure they'll sell them. Personally, I thought it was a pernicious development and just stupid. But
Did you think the Porsche Cayenne when it first came out?
I'm afraid I do, and I still do. I still think that
it was wrong for the brand.
I think it was wrong for the brand. It did. There's no question that people will buy those things, and I mean there is with a Bentley SUV coming and Lamborghini and the Maserati and all the new Porsche SUVs. You kind of wonder if they'll run out of, like, you know, rich, you know, look at me people to buy them. But I think they'll make a lot of money in the short run. I think in the long run, when 2/3 of your product, in Lamborghini's case, is selling SUVs, you know, whatever your core brand value is starts to erode, and that has to happen. Porsche's case, you know, they, you know, all that extra volume helped them do was lose control of the company, which was already extremely profitable. And while it may have served some larger Volkswagen, you know, world domination plan for them to, you know, wildly increase their volume and to share platforms and things like that. I think it really, you know, dilutes it. What does the Porsche brand stand for now that, you know, 85% of what they sell is Cayennes and Panameras? You know, Porsche's now, a friend of mine, we were in a Panamera, and he said, this isn't true to the Porsche brand. And I said, well, no, it is, because the Porsche brand now is 2.5-ton cars that are incredibly fast and handle surprisingly well for just, like, you know, how large they are. And that, to me, you know, you lose something. And I wonder if Porsche took all the energy and money and time that they spent doing that, whether we wouldn't already have the 2,000-pound, you know, 200-horsepower, but just as fast 911 that they probably could build, that they have the talent to build, and whether that wouldn't be a more exciting company.
Very interesting points. Well, okay, the analysts, how do you guys see that? Is this going into SUVs wrong for brands like Lamborghini and Porsche?
I think from my perspective, it is, to be honest with you. I mean, I looked at that Bentley, monster Bentley SUV, and it's just like so over the top. I mean, clearly it's just an idea of where they want to go with it, but, you know, some of the jewelry on the car, the way they trimmed it out, and the front end, even the back end for that matter, was just way, way over the top. One thing about the luxury market, at least as it relates to the U.S. market, my experience in the metropolitan area here is that it's very, very heavily driven by leasing. So you'll see, and I noticed in my neighborhood, you'll see someone driving a Range Rover that they've leased for 2 or 3 years, and, oh, we did the Range Rover thing, now it's time to do the Cayenne thing, and then next year it'll, or 2 years from now, it'll be time to do an Evoque, if you will. So I characterize it as leasing promotes disloyalty to the brand. It, you know, certain people, they'll lease their Mercedes, whatever, S-Class or E-Class forever, but there's a whole cadre of particularly the younger people who love to try new things. So they just, all they want to do is lease it. I've got a $700 a month car payment, as far as I'm concerned, for the rest of my life, and I'm just going to keep trying new things.
So John, that's must put a real premium on constantly coming out with new product.
Yes, it certainly does. I mean, I think when we look what's going on in the industry, just to comment on the luxury CUVs or SUVs, if you will, I mean, I think a lot of these companies are looking at using their current architectures, sort of souping them up a little bit to create these larger vehicles. The Explorer is off the same platform as the Flex and the Taurus, so Ford is doing that. Porsche is doing that. Lambo, I'm sure, is doing that as well. So there might be a real business case here. There's a question of staying true to the brand or making money. I think a lot of these companies might be a little bit more focused on making incremental profits off some of the investments that they've made already. So it's, you know, the enthusiasts might not be that happy with it. The guys who are the equity owners might be happy with it. So it's sort of a push and pull there on the profits versus the loyalty to the brand. Right. But I think as far as the product launches, I think as we've seen this all touring the New York Auto Show over the past couple of days, is there's a ton of great product out there. And we, you know, do this forecast each year. We do a call Car Wars, and the product that's coming out over the next 3 years is probably about 50 models on average over the next 3 years, and that's a huge increase from about 35 over the last 3 years. So there's going to be a ton of new product that's going to pull people into the showrooms, not just on the luxury side, but also on the mass market side, particularly in CUVs and the mid-car segment, which are big people mover segments, which really should pick up as the economy picks up.
Back to that point, though, I would say that there's no question that it's like, for them, it must seem like there's money lying on the table. And certainly with the explosion in the Chinese market and the you know, Russian market and the Indian market and all these people who, you know, have rather vulgar taste, there's no other way to describe it. Things like this Bentley SUV or the Lamborghini, they're gonna sort of appeal. But I sort of feel like there's an obligation that if you're the steward of a brand that's different than just being, you know, going out for the highest return, and that's not just an auto industry problem, it's a societal problem that we have. But, you know, to say, you know, and you will say, you go, like, to, you know, at a dinner after a couple glasses of wine, you'll ask an executive, you know, like, what is with, like, you know, the Q7 Audi? It was like so, you know, like, what a, you know, abhorrent idea to traditional Audi fans. They go like, oh, but we were leaving so much money out there. You know, there's money to be made selling crack cocaine to school children, and just because you could make money doing it doesn't mean you should do it. And just because you could make money, you know, doing anything doesn't mean that's why you should do it. And I think that's sadly, that's the best reason they really have.
Well, this is interesting. So do you think a few more years down the road, this is really going to hurt brands that are doing that?
Oh, I think so. You know, they water themselves down, and they become, they kind of lose their initial fans. You know, you sort of saw it in a, it's not exactly analogous, but what happened to Saab? You know, they managed in a fairly short period of time to alienate everybody who was a Saab fan, and then, you know, they were doing what Joe was saying. There were people would go, well, that's a cheap lease price. I'll get that car and try it and see if it's any good. And, you know, it wasn't that great anyway, but they had lost their fans. And that happens a lot, and I think that ultimately that doesn't make for strong, you know, brands. I think it makes for weaker brands.
But these manufacturers are all chasing the almighty dollar. So they can, you know, they
But what if Jamie's right? What if it really does end up hurting your brand?
Well, we think it will, but I don't think they really give a damn. Right? As long as the operating profit margin, you know, either stays high or gets to a new level and stays at that level, you know,
But that's the fundamental problem is that there's this notion, and it's just, you know, it's capitalism is what we used to call it, that every quarter is supposed to be better than the quarter before. And, I'm in finance, man, so, you know, I mean, that seems ridiculous to me because nothing in life is ever that way. There's no reason you should expect that. And there are even, you know, farmers let their fields lie fallow sometimes when, you know, it's the right time to do it. But just that, like, money now. And not even, like, let's have a five-year plan. It's like next quarter, you know, that's pretty much what the focus is. It creates, you know, I would say the incentives are perverse.
The one thing to sort of focus on, though, with these companies is they're looking at 5 to 6 year life cycles on a product platform. They're spending $1 to $2 billion on each platform. Amortizing that over a larger set of products does make a lot of sense. It's actually really not focused. You can see this at Ford. This is not something that's been focused on a quarterly basis, nor do they necessarily focus on each quarter for earnings. They focus on the long term, and that really began in 06. So I think you see some pretty good discipline coming from these auto executives more recently, at least in the companies that we cover. And I think I am sort of hard-pressed to believe that you shouldn't necessarily try to earn higher returns in the long run by producing more models off the same platforms. I think there is a huge challenge on the luxury side. I don't think the Porsche 911 has really been that impaired by the Cayenne. I would argue maybe the Cayman going downstream is more damaging to the 911 than the Cayenne is on the high end.
I don't know if the sales bear that out, but I mean, your point is well taken, and there certainly is discipline. But I sort of feel, and you know, this is maybe an old-fashioned or perhaps you know non-existent point of view, but just that they have an obligation to lead their customers somewhere rather than, you know, they'll go like, well, this is what our customers tell us they want. You know, that's why we have to sell them these things that really embarrass us anyway. But you know. You know, Porsche, for instance, you know, they articulated a lifestyle and a brand and everything about it so well for so long. And it was that kind of focus that they start to lose. The other thing is that happens is that, you know, their luxury brands are supposed to be exclusive. And when you just go, oh, we're going to triple our volume, you know, overnight and with something that has nothing to do with us. Well, you know, it reminds me of I was in Los Angeles and Santa Monica about 6 months ago, and I was test driving a Bentley Continental, and I pulled up at a four-way traffic light, and there were six Bentley Continentals, including mine there. And you know, the other guys were—I was laughing, but the other guys were kind of looking a little squeamish about it.
All these luxury sales going so well, generating so many profits, certainly in America, and maybe not Europe right now, but most of the rest of the world. These car companies are making really good money. John, why is their stock really going nowhere right now?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons. Europe is certainly a big concern. All the mass market manufacturers have pretty good exposure. So do the luxury guys have pretty good exposure over there, or not so good exposure, but it's big exposure in the grand scheme of the companies. The U.S. market is really on fire right now. China's doing okay. South America is waffling a little bit. But if you get outside of North America, people are still nervous about what's going to happen in the macro global economy. So the stocks are reflecting that right now. I do think as we get some semblance of stability, the U.S. SAR continues to chug well above 14 million units, that the stocks will begin to work. there's a lot of fear out there. You had two big manufacturers go bankrupt in the summer of 2009. We're in early 2012. That's not too long ago that we had big bankruptcies. So I think investors have a healthy level of skepticism, and they'll come around on these stocks over time as the cash flow continues to come through.
Is that how you see it, Joe? Because
yeah, I do.
When you look at GM, Ford, and Chrysler, certainly in their North American operations, they're at all-time record levels of profitability.
Well, you know, they cut their costs, dramatically. And it's amazing what happens when volume turns up and you get past using, you know, roughly 75 to 80% of your capacity. You know, the profitability just explodes. You know, if you look at what's happening with the Jeep Grand Cherokee, filling up Jefferson North, you know, adding a third shift. And plus the fact that they've now they've broken the $50,000 barrier for a Grand Cherokee. And the folks at Chrysler and Jeep often marvel at the fact that they don't seem to know where the top end of pricing on a Jeep is, for example. And so you take a $25,000 Jeep Grand Cherokee, you dress it up in a bit of a tux, and all of a sudden you're looking at close to $50,000 in terms of MSRP, and a huge amount of that drops to the bottom line. Getting back to Jamie's comment, I think the big three are much more disciplined in terms of, you know, going after niches as opposed to looking at someone like BMW, probably the most egregious example of taking a platform and slicing that chunk of cheese in as many thin little pieces as they possibly can, with churning out a new iteration of a 5 Series or a 3 Series almost every 6 months.
Well, I think the difference is that BMW charge you for that variation. So whereas you see the mass market brands trying to simplify their manufacturing build by not having as many permutations to cut cost, BMW doesn't care at all, but they charge the customer for it. Don't you think that's a key reason why they're able to get away with having so much complexity in their manufacturing operations?
Well, they do. And I mean, they get paid very well for what they give you, all right? The other thing is, as John was alluding, China, right? An enormous market, huge growth in the 1%, if you will, or the 1 or 2%. So there's a tremendous opportunity for premium and luxury vehicles in that market, and that's obviously going to drive the numbers as well. Less so in South America, for example, but.
Yeah, I think Joe hit on a very key point for the Detroit 3, specifically on the Grand Cherokee and the price point being so high. I think one of the big changes in the industry is that you've gotten a very healthy level of inventory that's been worked down over a number of years. Really, in the summer of 2009 was where we had this big washout of inventory, cash for clunkers, GM and Chrysler taking a lot of plants down. You're really very low on the inventory levels relative to history. So there's a real tightness on dealership lots right now, which is driving pricing higher, as well as this very disciplined focus by the Detroit 3, who historically didn't have a great focus on keeping inventory tight and pushing pricing higher. So that really is creating a real sort of halo for pricing and some of these higher line products inside the Detroit 3 that nobody thought you could get better than $50,000 for before. It's a real boon for them, and it does drop to the bottom line.
So thinking back to John's comment about the stocks, you know, the biggest single worry, obviously, is an inability in Europe to address the issues of excess capacity in Europe. You know, no one wants to blink, no one wants to move first. And we look at the agony that GM's going through trying to deal with the Opel situation.
Yeah. It's the old adage, everyone wants to go to heaven and nobody wants to die. Jamie, one of the things I'm worried about when I hear all this talk about pricing and whatnot, inventory levels so tight, used car prices high, is simply the price of cars going up and up and up. I'm thinking by 2015 we're going to see in the United States the average vehicle sticker at about $35,000. Aren't we in danger of leaving a lot of people behind in the industry?
I don't think particularly more than in the past. I don't think that's not what I lie awake at night worrying about. You know, people's houses are cheaper to buy now. That's the good news, I guess. So you can spend it on your car.
Any comment on that?
Well, I'm very concerned about the next, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. Because cars are going to get incredibly expensive. Apropos your comment, as the car makers have to, you know, take weight out, right, reduce mass dramatically, go to ever more sophisticated, you know, powertrains, et cetera. And the the creep, and I shouldn't even call it creep, it's going to be more of a gallop in terms of pricing over the next several years to meet the 54 mile per gallon standard. It's going to put a lot of vehicles, new vehicles, if you will, out of the reach of a substantial number of consumers. Now, the flip side would be, you know, well, they're forced into a used vehicle, and that buoys up, you know, used vehicle prices and residuals and trade-in values. But I'm still very concerned that that it's going to be it's a problem for the industry, and it could be worse than we expect, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that incremental content, it definitely is a pressure point for the industry. I think one of the interesting things is, though, that the industry has done a very good job of increasing the efficiency of the engine over time. That massive increase in efficiency, which has really been quite dramatic, has resulted in a massive increase in horsepower as opposed to better fuel economy. If you were to look at a car 10 years ago, it now has 30 to 50% better horsepower today than it did 10 years ago. So there's been a huge push for sort of this gluttonous, you know, drive for horsepower on the pickup truck side, on the and even in the mid-car platform, the basic family movers. So I do think over time there's going to be more content that comes in as you keep that horsepower high. I'm not sure that the industry can't slowly address this over time and they can push the pricing up for consumers, but it is a risk.
And on that note, we're going to have to close it up. But Jamie, John, and Joe, thanks so much for coming
Thank
on
you.
AutoLine
thanks,
this week. Very interesting
thanks.
Discussion.
Thanks a lot, John.
What a great discussion that we had today. Everything from technology to car sales to luxury vehicles. In fact, maybe a little too much luxury. I've really got to thank my guests today. Jamie Kittman from Automobile Magazine, John Murphy from the Bank of America, Joe Philippi from Auto Trends. Hey, join us again here next week for another edition of AutoLine This Week.